From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall at cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 440 for this May the 12th, 2013. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you're listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be taking your calls shortly at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. Looking forward to speaking with you today. All our lines are open, hoping that you call in early, and what we tend to find, as always, is that around, with about 15 minutes left in the show, we usually get a flood of calls that come in, either because of some of the topics that people have been brought up, or it reminds them of something that they wanted to ask. So if you have anything you would like to talk about, please call early. That way we get more opportunity to be able to flesh out some of the ideas and also give people an idea of maybe there's something they want to talk about as well. And we've had a lot of calls and a lot of questions, and we've had guests on the show talking about atrial fibrillation. And part of the problem with atrial fibrillation is that for some people, it's difficult to control. Medications don't work very well. Sometimes when they have what's called an ablation, which is almost is a means of, for lack of a better word, zapping with a little electrical current, an area in the heart that is thought to be responsible for producing the irregular rhythm that leads to atrial fibrillation. But there's a new technique that's been presented actually yesterday at the Heart Rhythm Society's National Scientific Sessions in Denver, Colorado. And this was presented by the Intermountain Heart Institute at Intermountain Medical Center. And what they have been able to do is use a new three-dimensional technology that for the first time gives cardiologists the ability to see exactly where the irregular electrical impulses are coming from in the heart, as opposed to trying to take a best estimate of where they think it is. And so it maps the electric signals that are in the heart and gives a three-dimensional picture of this. And so it improves the chances to successfully eliminate the irregular heart rhythm when you do that ablation. And so this particular study, it was a small study, so we have to keep that in mind. It was 49 people. Study was conducted between 2012 and this year. And what these 49 patients had was this 3D mapping technology compared to 200 patients who had similar conditions and who received conventional treatment without the 3D method. So they had ablations, but they didn't use that three-dimensional method. And at the end of this study, after a year, they found that those people that had the catheter ablation, that's the little tube that they wind up through the blood vessels to get into the heart, 79% of the patients who had the 3D procedure were free of their atrial fibrillation, compared to 47.4% of patients who underwent the standard ablation procedure alone without the three-dimensional imaging. So this three-dimensional imaging technique in the similar type of patient, and these were participants 65, an average of 65 years old, and 94% of them had persistent and chronic atrial fibrillation, and they all had failed medications. So that's the type of group that they were looking at. And so they're now going to, again, continue to use this particular procedure for these specific individuals. And again, these were people that failed on medical therapy to control the heart rhythm. And in about, for every 4 out of 10 of them, so out of those 49 patients, about 10 or 11 of them or 12 of them had prior catheter ablations. They had that area zapped before with conventional means that didn't work, and now it tended to work for them. So I found that very interesting. Again, this is in the United States, and it was just presented yesterday. I'm sure what will happen is that they will continue these studies to see if there's other people who may benefit from this, what the risks are. The risks are likely the same in terms of the catheter ablation. It's the same technique. The only thing different is that they're given a better roadmap. So instead of looking at a two-dimensional picture and trying to guess where in that two-dimensional picture they think the center of the storm, so to speak, is, they now have a three-dimensional structure that gives them depth. So they now can figure out exactly where on the surface inside the heart, on the surface of the heart, where these electrical impulses are coming from and be able to do those ablations. How long it lasts, part of the problem with ablations is that even when you do them, for some people, and we had Dr. Michael Golub, who was on last year, who is an expert in atrial fibrillation and heart arrhythmias, saying that ablations can help, but the heart arrhythmia can return again and atrial fibrillation can come back again. So the interest in this is that although this procedure works and it was 1 year that they followed this, what we need to know is this more successful, not only initially in the first year, but 10 years out, do we see that it is still effective? And that we won't know until 10 years passes. We can't really speed up time in that way. But it is important because if we can control atrial fibrillation a bit better, having atrial fibrillation, people with atrial fibrillation are about 5 times more likely to have a stroke than people without the condition. It's a major, major cause of stroke and blood clots and also heart failure. So the more that we can treat this and the more effective we can, more effectively we can treat this, the less likely we will see these type of severe injuries. And again, we know that atrial fibrillation increases with age. So the median age for atrial fibrillation is about 66, 67 years of age in men and about 75 years of age in women when you see this, but it can occur earlier or a little bit later. But in effect, what's very encouraging about this and what I find really cool about this is the way they have used computer technology, which are in evaluating these electrical impulses and creating this three-dimensional picture. And what's also something to keep in mind is that these type of approaches with modeling technology, with three-dimensional technology, is not restricted just to the heart. So the same procedures that they're using here may help, for example, with regards to brain function or epilepsy or abnormal electrical signals coming from within the brain, locating more precisely where the damage is. That may be something that they use that in terms of approaching neurological conditions. It's essentially endless because a lot of times we create these technologies, we create different approaches for evaluating and diagnosing and treating, and it's almost like the law of unintended consequences. You don't know where this actually leads. It may lead to applications that you had never originally considered when you first started trying to develop this particular technology, and someone says, hey, you know, in my area, I can apply this in this way. So that's what I find quite interesting and quite exciting about the changes that we're seeing and the rapid changes we are seeing to technological advances in diagnosing and treating various medical conditions. When we come back, our lines are almost full. We still have a couple of lines left. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call and back with your calls in just a few minutes.
Captain, how soon can you land?
I can't tell.
You can tell me I'm a doctor.
No, I mean, I'm just not sure.
Or can't you take a guess?
Well, not for another 2 hours.
You can't take a guess for another 2 hours?
Mrs. Simpson, I'm afraid your husband is dead. April Fool's. He's very much alive, although I'm afraid he may never walk again.
My motto is, if you can't make him laugh, make him sick.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Good.
521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is the long distance number. And we're going to line one, and good afternoon to Faye in Barrhaven.
Oh, good afternoon. A couple of weeks ago, you mentioned about an injection into a knee that might avoid knee surgery.
Well, not necessarily knee surgery, but reduce the pain from osteoarthritis. So it's not a replacement for knee surgery. It's more for people who have mild to moderate osteoarthritis of the knee.
Yes.
For someone that has severe osteoarthritis of the knee where knee surgery or a knee replacement is recommended, the injection is unlikely to be helpful. So it's really for people in the earlier stages. And the injection is a type of lubricant that's put into the knee joint.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, it works very well. For other people, it doesn't work at all. And the caveat to all of this is that it's quite expensive. The medication itself costs about $400 or $450.
Mm.
And there's no guarantee that it will work. It doesn't cost anything in terms of seeing a physician to have it injected. That's covered by OHIP. But the medication itself, it costs at the pharmacy about $400 and some odd. If you have insurance, private insurance, it's covered. But otherwise, it's not covered for people who are otherwise on ODSP or who are 65
and over.
How
does it differ from other injections into the knee?
Well, the difference is that when we talk about an injection, we're talking about what we're actually putting into the knee. So in some instances, injections involve steroid. So using the steroid itself is used as an anti-inflammatory to reduce some of the, damage or damage process that's going on in the knee joint. And it can work a little bit, but you're limited to how much you can use. And over time, it really doesn't, you know, it doesn't change what's going on inside the knee.
This would be better than the steroids.
Well, it's
probably
not necessarily better. It's just something different. So this in itself is a type of compound that the knee joint itself would normally produce. It's the sort of, again, the lubricant that allows the cartilage surfaces to glide over each other. Literally, it's like oil in a joint. You know, when you put oil in a joint, it moves smoothly. As if the oil disappears, you get a rusty hinge and it sticks and it doesn't move. Well, so that's what this stuff does, is when you inject it, it gives a little bit better lubrication and allows the knee in this case to move with less pain. But again, it really is dependent on the individual, and you could have two people with exactly the same condition of the knee, and yet one would respond to the injection and the other wouldn't respond as well. So it really is a matter of, in some cases, it's just a buyer beware type of thing, where you go in with your eyes open, knowing that, okay, I'll try this, but also knowing that it may not help. It can help, but it may not as well. So that's the problem with it. So when I have patients that come into the office and they want to talk about this, I'll mention, first of all, that it's very expensive. It's an easy procedure to do. It literally takes 5 minutes to do, but that they're aware that it may not work. I tend to be more pessimistic so that the person is not disappointed. And if it does work, they're certainly very happy about it, but you don't want to overpromise on something like this.
Well, could you tell me the name of it, please?
Yeah, there's a couple of them. One is called Synvisc, S-Y-N-V-I-S-C, Synvisc. And the other, which is very similar, called Durolane, D-U-R.
D.
D, as in
yes.
D-U-R-O-L-A-N-E.
O-R.
So D-U-R-O-L-A-N-E.
O-L-A-N-D.
Yeah, Durolane.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is the long-distance number. And we're going to line two, and Peter in Centertown. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, doctor. Excuse me. I work out quite a bit, and one day I was looked in the mirror and I flexed my right bicep and it seemed to be an abnormal shape.
Okay.
So I went to the doctor and they sent me for an ultrasound. And I go back for the results, they call me in.
Okay.
And she said, you ruptured your bicep.
Mm-hmm.
But I experienced no pain.
That can happen. It's not necessarily an injury that leads to a lot of pain, but rather just an abnormal shape on the biceps area of the arm itself.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, now the I guess the person that looked at the not the doctor, I guess whoever looked at the results of my ultrasound mm-hmm. recommended an MRI.
Okay, and
now,
so
also they're also recommending maybe once I guess they get the results of that, which is months I guess from now, mm-hmm. They're gonna maybe do surgery.
They might. The usual approach to the usual approach to surgery. And it's interesting you mentioned a biceps rupture because that's what I believe the Montreal Canadiens captain has is a biceps rupture, and he's out indefinitely until they do surgery to repair it. But surgery is usually when a surgeon is the indications for surgery is again athletes, people involved in sports that require significant use of their arm. Also people whose occupation depends on it to a significant degree. So, movers or people that do a lot of upper body work,
mm-hmm.
that's where they tend to repair it. And also people who are also very highly active. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I'm pretty highly active, but I can't do any real heavy lifting. So maybe I shouldn't have been doing, I guess I kind of overdid it.
It's usually when a tendon ruptures, it's usually because a lot of force was placed on that part of the arm. So it's not just the force itself. It's sometimes the way the arm is used, because a lot of times it's a snapping type of injury. That is, instead of moving a weight very slowly, you grab the weight and you sort of jerk the arm quickly. Mm-hmm. And when you jerk the arm quickly, it's like an elastic band.
So is it the actual tendon that ruptures or the muscle?
It's the tendon that ruptures.
Oh.
Yeah, it's where the tendon...
I've heard that it's very difficult for tendons to heal because of the fact that they don't get much blood.
You're absolutely correct in that tendons don't have a very good blood supply, unlike muscle, which is infiltrated with blood vessels.
Mm-hmm.
Tendons don't do that. And so in order to repair them, in this case too, especially with a muscle that gets contracted, when a tendon ruptures... That ball that you saw is essentially the muscle all contracted.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult to stretch that muscle out afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So not only do you have to try and stretch the muscle out, you have to then reinforce the tendon against the bone or attach it to something. And that's a lot of strain on that tendon to try and get it to heal onto the bone again, because that's what tendons do, is they attach to bone to allow the arm to move.
Right.
So you may be faced with more rehabilitation and conservative management,
right,
depending on what the MRI shows,
right,
as opposed to having surgery to repair it.
But you actually did say it was the muscle that ruptured and didn't say tendon.
A muscle rupture would have hurt you a lot.
Oh, I see.
You would be in agony. Just think of things like Charlie horses and things like that.
Well, I had a lot of surgery because I got to get it.
Yeah, usually it's the tendon that ruptures. The ultrasound or the MRI that they're doing is used for detail, in order to really detail the tendon itself to see where the tear has happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually, again, they usually do this when there are more severe or prolonged symptoms of damage. So, I mean, we'll see what happens with the MRI, but again, the orthopedic surgeon may say, if you are functional, they may not want to operate because... Right. The operation itself may make things worse.
Right. Now, I got one more thing.
Sure.
First time I went, there was another issue I had, but that's minor. It was found out all right. But she said, my blood pressure was a bit high.
Mm-hmm.
But I just see a white coat and it goes up.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you can't.
But she said, we'll just keep an eye on it. Kind of take it every once in a while to see how it is.
Right.
But the next doctor, when I'm going back for the results of the mm-hmm. ultrasound, he said, you got high blood pressure, you need medication.
Well, before you can diagnose high blood pressure, the best test to do to evaluate that is what's called a 24-hour ambulatory blood pressure
mm-hmm.
monitor. That is, you wear a blood pressure cuff over 24 hours, so you're out of the office, mm-hmm. you're at home, it's measured while you're sleeping, while you're working, while you're doing stuff. And that will tell us more often whether there indeed is high blood pressure. Depending on an office reading, a few office readings is not the way to diagnose it.
Right.
So what I would say is to get that done, if they're concerned about it, before you start taking any medication
quickly,
for it.
Quickly, I hear the music.
Yeah. All right. Actually, we have to go, Peter, because we're going for the news.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. And we're going to take a small break for the news and come back with your calls. 521-TALK, 521-8255. Star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is a long-distance number. You're listening to Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Back right after the news.
580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com. The advice and recommendations in this program are for general educational purposes and not a diagnosis. You should consult a physician or health professional directly before beginning or changing any course of health treatment.
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning, fever all through the night.
521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is a long-distance number. We have lots of lines available. Encourage you to call in before the show finishes. 521-TALK, 521-8255. We're going to go to line four and speak to John in Ottawa. Good afternoon. Hello, John.
Hello. Hi. Dr. Dworkin. I have a short question.
Sure.
I went for lunch today, mm-hmm. and when I was eating my lunch, I swallowed a strip of salt cod.
Okay.
And it got down my throat without me chewing it, mm-hmm. because it was so slippery in that.
Mm-hmm.
And now I this spoiled the rest of my lunch, and I have pains in my stomach. I think it got down that far,
mm-hmm.
and I'm wondering what I should do. It's still, you know, bothering me.
Mm-hmm.
And should I do anything at home, or should I go to the emergency?
Well, now, are you having any difficulty now swallowing food or swallowing liquids?
I can swallow it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there's probably very little that you can do right now, John, especially if it's made its way into the stomach. It's likely because it was swallowed whole,
mm-hmm.
it's just more difficult for your body to digest, right?
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't been chewed, so your stomach enzymes and acid has to work on it, and then it has to go into the intestines. So there's probably very little in terms of risk to your health of what it's going to do. It's just the fact that, you know, it's a larger piece. And it's just not something the stomach has, you know, has to deal with in terms of a whole piece of, in this case, a whole piece of fish that went down. So,
yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I do have a hiatus hernia, by the way. So
right.
Does that make any difference?
The only thing that it might do is it might give you a bit more reflux. You might find that you get more acid that comes up a bit into the esophagus and gives you some discomfort. And if there's medication that you have for that, you know, something to treat heartburn, you can certainly use that.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, in terms of the effect it's going to have on you, probably not too much. You may get some cramps and some pain, but that's only because of the physical nature and size of the food that was taken in.
Should I be taking like something like Enos or something, or
no? Again, I probably wouldn't do. I think in this case, less is more. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, just I would probably let your body do what it needs to do. Mm-hmm. If, on the other hand, you start getting some reflux and you get heartburn, then you may want to use something to reduce the acid in your stomach to make yourself a little bit more comfortable. But but other than that, there's probably very little to do. I wouldn't do anything to the stomach to bring anything back up. Given that this was how many hours ago that you ate?
Well, an hour and a half ago.
Yeah, so
yeah.
Likely with, you know, it's very likely that it's going to have already passed through the stomach and into the intestine. Usually things stay in the stomach for about half an hour or so and then pass on through. So it's likely made its way through, and it's just your body doesn't like it too much that it wasn't chewed before it was swallowed.
Doctor, that's super information, and I just want to say thank you.
You're very welcome, John.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is the long-distance number, and we have all the lines available, so please feel free to call in. I do have a few other things I wanted to bring up apropos to what was talked about with regards to knee injections. I also want to mention that I will be a guest with Rabbi Bulka this evening at 10 o'clock on his Sunday night show. For those of you who listen to the Good Rabbi, he usually invites me every 3 months or so to come on the show and to talk about issues. He likes to try and stump me and give me all kinds of questions out of left field. And it's a lot of fun. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is the long-distance number. Now, apropos to the question about injections, knee injections, and the medications that are available, and we talked about steroid injections and a couple of products that have what's called hyaluronic acid, which is what is produced in the knee joint. As the lubricant, and there's a couple of medications out there that are used to help people who have mild to moderate arthritis. Well, at Boston University, a biomedical engineer has developed a new joint lubricant that could bring longer-lasting relief to millions of people that have osteoarthritis. This was published in the Journal of the American Chemical Society, and again, this was to address what I mentioned earlier, that the best fluid supplements that are available today offer temporary symptom relief, but it often provides inadequate lubrication to prevent further breakdown of the knee joint itself and the cartilage surfaces that cushion the joint. And this was done, the person who did this was Professor Mark W. Grinstaff at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, Harvard Medical School, and orthopedic surgeon Brian Snyder, along with Boston University chemistry and engineering students, advanced this type of what's called synovial fluid. The synovial fluid is the knee joint fluid. It's called synovial fluid because it's produced by the synovium, which is literally the protective shell or membrane or bubble that surrounds the knee joint itself and keeps the fluid around the knee joint. And they've created this new polymer, and it reduces the friction between the two cartilage surfaces even more, so there's less wear and surface-to-surface interaction. And what they want to do now is use this in clinical trials to see how well it lasts. And they say because it's a very large size, the molecules of this particular polymer are a large size, it's less likely to seep out of the joint. It stays in the joint itself and provides longer-lasting cartilage protection. So, interesting. We'll see what happens with regards to this. It was just announced, actually, just last week, and we'll see what happens over time. But again, they are trying to work on means of protecting the knee joints. Knee replacement surgery does help. It's significant surgery, very costly surgery. And the longer you can keep someone active without pain and maintaining their function without having to resort to surgery, it obviously is better for the patient to have that as opposed to moving towards surgery. So again, very encouraging news, and hopefully this leads to products that will help and allow us to provide this to people, and hopefully it will give a longer-lasting type of relief. We're going to go to line one and speak to Louise in the PN. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My question is, what can be done to treat sciatica?
Well, depending on what's causing the sciatica, usually what causes sciatica is a ruptured disc that presses on one of the nerves that comes out of the back. It's sort of the lower lumbar area of the back, and causes pain that goes down one leg, not both legs. It can give severe back pain, and the pain will radiate right down to the foot.
That's what I'm dealing with.
The most common course of treatment for sciatica is, again, depending on of how it was diagnosed, has it been diagnosed? Did they tell you what's causing it?
My chiropractor said I did have a weakness for one disc to press on the other. My GP has scheduled me to have an MRI toward the end of the month.
Okay. Yeah, because the MRI will tell us, first of all, if a disc has been ruptured. You can't really tell if a disc is ruptured by pressing on the back. The only way you can tell is by doing a few, there's a couple of physical exam procedures that might be helpful, mm-hmm. but it still will not tell us per se exactly where the damage is. So one of the ways to know if there is a disc that's ruptured is something called a straight leg raise. That is, you're sitting just in a chair,
okay.
and the clinician will take the leg that's affected and lift the, he'll grab the heel of the foot from behind the foot. He or she will lift that foot up straight so that your leg will be at a 90-degree angle to your back. And if that doesn't cause any pain, it's less likely to be sciatica. If they take your foot while your leg is lifted up and they push the top of your foot towards you, you know, so your toes towards you, and you get pain that gets recreated that way, that tells us that there's a nerve that is being compressed. But if that is not happening, then it's less likely to be sciatica. Because again, the idea is that if there is a disc that is ruptured, the disc squeezes out between the two bones, the vertebrae, and pushes right against the nerve.
Okay, what is the treatment for a ruptured disc then?
The usual treatment is conservative therapy. They are really hesitant to do surgery on that. They like to give at least, depending on when the injury occurred, they like to give at least 12 to 16 weeks for the disc to sometimes regress, because usually after an injury, you have a lot of inflammation. And with a lot of inflammation, you get a lot of pressure. And the pressure in itself can also be pushing on the disc. So they like to wait that time to see if the pressure diminishes. And if the pressure diminishes, a lot of times the disc moves away from the nerve and the pain recedes. So they usually, again, don't want to do any surgery until they give it that time. They'll usually use medications to help for pain. Again, that's within limits. If someone has an acute back injury and they're paralyzed in their leg, they can't use their leg at all, there's a really severe damage, they'll sometimes operate. But for somebody that's able to walk a bit, they're having pain, but they're able to function, they'll usually give that person a bit of time to see if it goes away. You don't want to press on the back. You don't want to manipulate the back. You don't want to lift things up off the floor. You don't want to do anything that creates any strain on the lower back. So I would avoid any manipulation of the lower back to try and make things better, because that usually will make things worse.
Okay, well, I'm taking some pain medication now, but there are times in the morning, you know, this 0 to 10 on the scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's sometimes it's 7.5 or an 8, but after the pain medication, 2 hours later,
yeah.
I can function.
Well, then that's good to know. Are you taking any of the medication before you get out of bed?
Yes.
Oh, you are. Okay, that's good. So I would wait for that MRI, because the only way you're going to know what's going on is by doing that. Because
okay.
Once you have a diagnosis, it's a lot easier to know what to do. But in the interim, everything that you do should be to really baby that back, to not do anything to put any strain on that lower back. It doesn't mean you shouldn't move around. In fact, you're encouraged to mm-hmm. walk and to be active, but just not to lift anything or bend down to pick things up or do anything that squeezes on the lower back, which usually involves a lot of bending or twisting.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Louise.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. We're going to take a small break, and when we come back, we have Yvonne in Orleans, who would like to talk about pancreatitis, and Cheryl in Ottawa would like to discuss bone density screening. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and back with your calls in just a few minutes.
If my dog can try to scare me out of smoking my dog, you know, show me a picture, a smoker's lung. Oh, it's gross and disgusting. Then he showed me a picture of a healthy guy's lung. Oh, it was gross and disgusting. But I put him on the inside. I have to look at him all the time, you know?
Wilson, what are you doing?
Hi, Rotem. I'm just testing my maracas.
Usually when I have mind tested, the doctor makes me turn my head and cough.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580. CFRA.
Silence. She blinded me with silence. Fell in
521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. And we're going to line two, and good afternoon to Yvonne in Orleans.
Hi, Dr. Dorgan.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Yes, I've been having a pain in my upper left quadrant for a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the emergency, and they did a CT scan and found that I had acute pancreatitis.
Okay.
And so the doctor gave me a prescription per cassette.
Okay.
Now, I don't drink and I don't smoke, so I had a viral infection, I guess some kind of cold before, flu symptom before I had this.
Right.
So, but the pain is so severe, it just keep going. I didn't know what it was. So now that we know, how long is this thing supposed to last and what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to look for? I know they said, go to my family doctor, I guess after 5 days if it doesn't go away or something. But I don't know. What do you think?
Well, usually, I'm surprised that you were sent home if you had pancreatitis.
Oh.
When the pancreas gets inflamed, usually patients are admitted to hospital and they're given intravenous fluids and they're told not to eat anything because eating can actually make it worse.
Yeah, that's what I find.
I'm just a bit confused that they sent you home if they diagnosed you with pancreatitis.
Well, they asked if I was vomiting, and I wasn't vomiting, and I wasn't having having diarrhea or any of those things.
Yeah, but the problem is that because I don't know there's usually blood tests that are done in order to see how severe the injury is. There's a couple of enzymes that they look at in the blood to see if the pancreas is really inflamed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have that information. So all I can say to you is that I'm very surprised if they diagnosed acute pancreatitis that they sent you home.
Mm.
I would probably speak to your, how are you feeling right now?
Well, I take the Percocet, and then it tone the pain down.
But you're still but you're still having pain.
Oh yeah, I have the pain after the 6 hours is up.
Okay. Well, what I would say, Yvonne, is that if they diagnosed pancreatitis, there's one of two. Well, there's two options. One is to go back to the emergency room and say, why did you send me home if I have pancreatitis? When usually the treatment is to be admitted and observed and to give fluids because you can't eat for that time that you have pancreatitis, or to see your doctor tomorrow morning and to say, look, this is what they diagnosed.
Yeah.
What can we do about this? Because I'm not comfortable telling you that everything is okay if they told you that you have pancreatitis. It's not a condition that I would I would expect someone to be sent home with.
Okay. Okay, I'll call my doctor tomorrow morning then.
All right.
Okay.
Take care, Yvonne.
Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. And going over to Cheryl in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I have a question. I was wondering what the standard of care is in regards to bone density screening.
Mm-hmm.
Just because my mom, she is, she'll be 65 next month,
yep.
or actually in a couple of weeks.
Right.
And she's been asking for years for a baseline sort of screen. She's diabetic, she's hypothyroid now, she has a number of things.
Mm-hmm.
And her doctor has always told her that she doesn't need it. And so I just wonder if there's a set standard of care for that, or if it just depends on what your doctor thinks you should have.
No, that's a great question. In fact, there is. There are now new 2010 guidelines that have a nice, and actually you can even get these guidelines at the website osteoporosis.ca.
Okay.
And we use these all the time because there are, usually for a woman that's 65, they usually would get a bone density at 65.
Okay, now, if so there's only...
Yeah.
Sure, yeah.
So if they have previous history of fractures, if there's a family history of fractures, if they have had other specific illnesses. I mean, this whole it goes through the whole chart of where you follow someone down. You see when they need to get the screening, how often they need to be screened, what happens with the result, and how, you know, how many years afterwards do you check? Does someone need to be treated based on? No, it really shows a really good review of that, and it's not easy to talk about on the radio because there are three different tracks, and as you follow down, you'll see exactly where your mom would fall into which category, and based on the category, the recommendations for screening follow. So, but you're absolutely right in that it's not on the basis of a physician deciding; it's based on what the guidelines are, and I would recommend, in fact, even bringing those guidelines into the office if the physician is still saying, well, there's no need to do it, especially if those guidelines make that recommendation to do so.
Okay. So even, could it be so far that they've said no because she is not 65 yet? And
yes. I mean, usually if someone is otherwise healthy, the recommendations are not to do very much of anything. Okay. But again, because I don't know your mom's medical history, the medical history plays a role in those guidelines as well.
Okay, so it's not just automatic after your postmenopausal or
correct.
Anything
it's,
like
it's,
that.
It's okay. Definitely not automatic.
Okay, great. Well, thank you.
You're very welcome. Bye now.
Bye.
And that about wraps up our show. My thanks to Dave Tripp for producing Sunday House Call, and your call is always interesting and informative. And just a reminder, I'll be on tonight as a guest of Rabbi Bilka on his Sunday night show at 10 o'clock. You've been listening to Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Have a great week.